The founder of the San Diego advocacy group Border Angels is injured but safe after he disappeared in Mexico for nearly 5 days. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Late last week, Border Angels founder Hugo Castro pleaded for help in Spanish on Facebook Live, saying criminals were hunting him. He turned up wounded in a city in the state of Mexico Tuesday. Jean Guerrero of KPBS reports Castro was found after investigators from the Office of the Special Prosecutor for Disappeared Persons received an anonymous phone tip describing his location.
Mexican investigators say Castro was found alive and that they'd be sharing more details soon. He disappeared on his way to help refugees on behalf of the San Diego advocacy group Border Angels. Founder Enrique Morones says he was delighted to learn that Castro was still alive.
There's been so many people helping us, the U.S. government, the Mexican government, organizations, individuals, and we really want to thank everybody because it takes a team effort. And he is so loved by so many people. And I'm sure that positive energy and all the help from so many people played a key role.
More than 10,000 people are missing in Mexico. According to some estimates, only about 1% of those who go missing are ever found. For Fronteras, I'm Jean Guerrero.
Thousands of people have gone missing in Mexico. An investigation is underway into Hugo Castro's disappearance and whether or not he was kidnapped. Jean Guerrero discussed more details about what was known about the incident on Wednesday with her KPBS colleague, Maureen Cavanaugh.
Tell us what you know about Hugo Castro's condition and where he is now.
So his family is not answering questions right now from the media per the instructions of Mexico's attorney general. However, Gabo Cortez, his partner, posted on Facebook last night that he was in very delicate condition, that the medical prognosis was, quote, unquote, guarded. I'm not exactly sure what that means. However, the police did say that he was going to survive, that it appeared he'd received a beating, a severe beating, but that he would survive. So he's receiving medical treatment in a Red Cross facility in the state of Mexico.
After days of no word from Castro, how was he finally found?
The partner, Gaba Cortez, she was just about to have a meeting with the Mexican investigators to view some footage of private security cameras that they were hoping would yield clues about his whereabouts. And suddenly the investigators got a phone call, an anonymous phone call, saying that Hugo Castro had been found on a street in this town called Tlalnepantla, in the state of Mexico, just outside of Mexico City. So immediately they took her to go pick him up. They took him straight to the hospital.
Are authorities confirming that he was kidnapped?
They have launched an investigation into what they call the illegal deprivation of freedom of Castro, which is, in my view, a sort of legalese for kidnapping. However, I've been trying to get further details from them, and I haven't been able to confirm that, in fact, he was kidnapped. But the fact that they've opened this investigation specifically into that crime suggests that they have some evidence that he was held against his will at some point during his disappearance.
Were U.S. authorities involved in the search, since Hugo Castro is a U.S. citizen?
Right. So the U.S. consulate in Tijuana was, I believe, the first one to be notified. And so they were working with the U.S. embassy in Mexico City to help with the Mexican federal investigators. I'm not sure exactly to what extent. And there were some claims that the FBI had also decided to participate, but I never got a comment back from the FBI.
So apparently they have issued no statement about his rescue.
No, they have declined to comment on his rescue.
Now, on this rather desperate Facebook video he posted last week, Hugo Castro said he was being hunted by a group of criminals. What kind of activity was he engaged in at that time?
He was on his way to a refugee caravan in southern Mexico, basically trying to raise awareness about the plight of Central American migrants who run into a lot of dangers crossing Mexico and are allegedly often turned away at the U.S. border, supposedly without having their cases fully reviewed. So this caravan was supposed to be raising awareness, and Castro was on his way down there in public transportation when he noticed, according to the Facebook Live video, that he was being followed. And initially he tried to, he said he tried to outsmart his pursuers by changing buses, changing cabs, and was very surprised to find that they'd followed him all the way to Mexico City.
Now, Castro is associated with the Border Angels advocacy group. You most recently reported on his work with Haitian refugees in Tijuana. Why would criminal organizations be interested in stopping him or his work?
So I think one thing that isn't often discussed, or there's not a lot of awareness on here in the U.S., is that migrants are actually one of the top sources of income for drug cartels, who have often diversified out of drugs into human trafficking, into kidnappings, other types of human exploitation. Because migrants are so vulnerable, they don't often want to call the police because often they are crossing through illegally. So Castro had received death threats in the past from criminals who said, you know, you're interfering with our livelihood, we're going to kill you.
Gene, when do you expect to hear more about his ordeal?
I'm in touch with Enrique Morones, the founder of Border Angels, who's following this obviously very, very closely. He's so glad that Castro has been found alive, and he'll have more details soon, hopefully. I believe that currently the family is being told to keep details under wraps because they're still in Mexico. But once they come back to the U.S., which will hopefully be once Castro has recovered, we'll know more.
That was Maureen Cavanaugh and Gene Guerrero of KPBS in San Diego. Mexico is weighing economic retaliation against the U.S. to counter what Mexicans say is an anti-Mexico Trump administration. One idea under consideration is a boycott of U.S. corn. Mexico is the number one export market for American corn, and U.S. corn producers recently went to Mexico to lobby against the idea. Marfa Public Radio's Lauren Madelon reports from Mexico City.
Every day, Antonio Godinez Vera turns imported American corn into feed for Mexican livestock. Some of that corn's also used to make tortillas, a staple of the Mexican diet. But corn's also a symbol of Mexico itself. Corn was born in Mexico 9,000 years ago. There's even an expression here, sin maíz no hay país, without corn there's no country. Now, legislation's been proposed to boycott U.S. corn in response to what Mexicans call the Trump effect.
El boicot puede ser dañino.
A boycott could certainly hurt us, Godinez says. It could also hurt U.S. corn growers from the Dakotas to the Midwest to Texas. Mexico's deputy economy minister, Juan Carlos Baker, told the Financial Times that negotiations are underway with Argentina and Brazil to offer them the same duty-free access to the Mexican market now enjoyed by U.S. growers under the North American Free Trade Agreement. President Donald Trump's called NAFTA the worst trade deal ever. Mexican Senator Armando Rios Peter has proposed the boycott.
The corn is from Mexico, from my country. So right now it's a very important position in a nationalistic way, but also in terms of trade.
Rios Peter says Brazilian corn is cheaper, though critics say he hasn't factored in the cost of moving corn from South America. He counters by saying this isn't strictly about cost, but about Mexico asserting itself in the face of economic threats.
Right now, when you have such a bully in Washington, me as a Mexican senator, as a Mexican citizen, I need to say this very loud and clear. Mexico is a serious player. Mexico has been a friend, but it can stop collaborating and it can take that kind of decisions.
The U.S. Grains Council, a trade group that helps U.S. growers export their product, has a full-time presence in Mexico City. The council says it's concerned that, quote, Mexican buyers feel they need to look at alternate suppliers, which could affect U.S. market share. Luis Rivera agrees. He studies the economics of agriculture at Texas A&M University.
We send $2.6 billion worth of corn to Mexico.
That's every year. Rivera says U.S. corn growers he speaks with are concerned.
It adds a lot of risk to a market that they have dominated because we're very competitive at producing corn, high-quality corn, and we have the advantage of having our market right next to us.
The idea of retaliating against the U.S. to counter any number of economic threats voiced by President Trump is popular on the street in Mexico. But it's unclear if Senator Rios Peter will generate enough support for a boycott that could spark social unrest.
We're gonna have higher prices for one of our staple foods.
Victor Hugo Michel is the chief editor at El Financiero Television.
70% of Mexicans consume more than 90 kilograms of corn a year. This means that if those Mexicans paid more for their tortillas, we could have a social instability.
Mexico's government is heading into an election next year, and it can't afford that risk. So this threatened boycott is unlikely to become reality. But the threat itself is unlikely to go away, given the current state of Mexico-U.S. relations. I'm Lorne Madelon in Mexico City.
Judges have ruled again that Texas deliberately discriminated against minority voters, this time in drawing district lines for the state House of Representatives. The 2-1 ruling Thursday by a federal panel found that Texas intended to weaken the influence of minorities by, quote, wasting Latino votes. The drawing of Texas voting maps is a long, complicated affair. The Texas Constitution requires the state legislature to redraw those districts after each census to make sure that the geographic boundaries contain the same amount of people. Minority advocacy groups did not like those 2011 maps and filed suit, saying they were deliberately designed to negatively affect Latino and African American voters, especially in districts from Dallas to San Antonio and out towards El Paso. TPR's Ryan Poppy reports a panel of federal judges recently agreed and ruled three Texas congressional districts were illegal.
After all these years, it's not surprising many Texans feel like Lelina Fisher, a graphic designer from Austin. Here's what she told us.
I've been wondering about the current status of Texas redistricting. With all the drawn and redrawn maps, the court cases, the appeals, and all the time that has elapsed, it's easy to lose track of this fundamentally important issue.
To understand where we're headed, let's look at where we've been. Minority advocacy groups sued the state in response to the maps the legislature approved in 2011. But the 2012 election was just around the corner, so a federal court implemented its own interim maps. The legislature liked those maps and officially adopted them during the 2013 legislative session. Problem solved, right? No. People like former State Representative Trey Martinez Fisher say those maps still intentionally diluted what had been traditional concentrations of Latino and African American voters.
In this instance, they said, well, let's draw some districts that look like they're minority opportunity districts, but they'll never have the opportunity because we can tell from election data that it'll never elect a candidate of its choice.
Cue another lawsuit. Martinez Fisher sits on the board of the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus and led the 2013 lawsuit against the state. Republican lawmakers disputed the lawsuit's claims. They said the maps the court had drawn were sufficient and should stand. Since then, the issue's kind of been in limbo. When Texans voted for their state house and congressional reps in 2014, they used those maps. The case was just sitting in federal court until this past March.
Federal judges could change the congressman who represents you. They decided in a 2-1 vote last night, three Texas congressional districts were drawn illegally.
That's when a three-judge panel from San Antonio decided that Texas's congressional redistricting efforts were intentionally drawn to discriminate against minority voters. According to Rafael Enchia, a Dallas Democrat who leads the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus, it happened in a few ways.
Whether they adopted in some areas of the state a packing technique that packed minorities into districts to dilute their voting strength, or they crack them in a way like you might do a wagon wheel where you take a concentrated community and you break it up into multiple districts.
Anchia, Fisher, and the rest of Malik are still in court, scrambling to neutralize the maps before voters go to the polls in 2018. So what happens now? After last month's decision by the federal court in San Antonio, they called the state and plaintiffs groups to court on April 27th. They'll try to figure out if there's a quick way they could remedy the situation. If not, they could order the legislature to handle it. But Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who presides over the Senate, has said that he doesn't see the need for the legislature to get involved until after the release of the next U.S. Census in 2020.
We will be back in session very shortly, in 2 years. That will be the session that begins to prepare us for the and 2021 for the new map. So I don't see any move to do that this session.
House lawmakers agree with him. They voted against dealing with redistricting this year. That's why Nina Perales, the lead attorney in the current lawsuit, says what happens next will come from the federal court system, not the state legislature, and they're running out of time.
Candidate filing opens in November 2017. We have to have lines drawn in time for the start of candidate filing this fall. And so there's a lot of time pressure on the court right now to make some decisions before the election schedule overtakes us.
Otherwise, Perales says, the federal district court in San Antonio will have to delay the start of the 2018 election. Ryan Poppy, Texas Public Radio News.
Coming up on Fronteras, voices from Mega Corazon, quite possibly the largest poetry event in the world.
It's this beautiful 10-hour constellation of voices. It is this collection of an incredible amount of talent that we have in San Antonio, incredible amount of heart and love.
More when we come back. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. April is National Poetry Month, and it was marked in San Antonio with what could be arguably called the biggest poetry event in the world. It's called Mega Corazón. This 10-hour live-streamed poetry marathon grew out of an idea by Carmen Tafoya, San Antonio's poet laureate, in 2014. That year, Tafoya staged a production called San Antonio, Mi Pueblo, which featured the works of 12 San Antonio poets woven together with music. That event grew and evolved into Mega Corazón. This year marks its fourth anniversary. George Cisneros, who's the media and music director at Urban 15, scored the Carmen Tafoya production that birthed Mega Corazón. He helped develop its evolution with Tafoya.
It's a poetry project. It's a way of listening to one of the earliest and most important ways of communication throughout all mankind. And our thought now is that with handheld devices and telephones, a poet in the handheld is worth two in the book.
The first half of Mega Corazón was pre-recorded. Poet Bryce Milligan was one of the first live performers to take the stage in the early evening.
Newly calved, the shards of ancient glaciers ride toward deeper waters, darker waters, beginning to melt even as the sea surrounds them, lapping freshwater wounds with salty tongues that cannot staunch the molecular awakening.
He was reading on a barren stage at Urban 15, a music movement and media space in South San Antonio. The stage setup consisted of a music stand and a lighted tarp in the background, and the few rows of chairs in front of the stage were mostly empty. But the camera facing him exposed him to an invisible audience of hundreds, perhaps thousands of people around the world. Milligan says Mega Corazón makes poetry accessible to everyone.
You know, generally you have to travel someplace, or you have to go buy a book, or you have to buy a ticket, and this is free access to some of the best material that San Antonio produces in terms of literature and music. So I think the imagination behind it is really at the core of what's important about it.
Poet Natalia Treviño followed Bryce Milligan on stage.
Socorro. Succor. Supplicant. Supple. Supper. Sigh. Señora, Our Lady, Grandmother, Abuela, Coco, whose powdered
She chose to read a poem that paid tribute to her abuelita Socorro, as well as other powerful religious and cultural Latina figures, including the Virgin of Guadalupe and Coatlicue, the Aztec goddess who's considered the mother of the gods, the sun, moon, and stars. Trevino, who's also an assistant professor of English at Northwest Vista College in San Antonio, says Mega Corazon is the biggest national Poetry Month event in the world.
I mean, it really is. It's this beautiful 10-hour constellation of voices. It is this collection of an incredible amount of talent that we have in San Antonio, incredible amount of heart and love. I think that's why they called it Mega Corazon, and I was right on board with that because there's so much love here that I think keeps the city in check and in balance.
Mega Corazon wrapped up this year with Anthony Flores, known around poetry circles as Anthony the Poet. His poem was a political one in which he plays the part of both a customs agent asking for the correct paperwork and the immigrant attempting to cross.
You there, crossing that river, come over here and show me your papeles. My papers, senor? Okay, here I come. Son, did you just pop me on the head with a cascarone? You asked to see my papeles, senor? Well, there they are, all over the place.
San Antonio is a city full of stories, 300 years worth. And next year's Mega Corazon will likely share a few more with the world. Norma Martinez, Texas Public Radio News.
And even though it's not Easter or fiesta yet, I decided to make these beautiful cascarones.
Audio from Bryce Milligan, Natalia Trevino, and Anthony the Poet from this year's Mega Corazon can be heard online at tpr.org. You'll find the link with our show information under the Programs tab. And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Shelley Koffler is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.